Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We're joined right now by Larry Summers of Harvard, a very special contributor here on Wall Street Week. So, Larry, great to have you with us on short notice. We've been talking about inflation on Wall Street Week for some time now. I know you're not hoping for more inflation, but you've been warning about it. What do you make of the numbers we saw today?
I was not hugely surprised by the numbers. In an economy that's growing faster than potential, with an unemployment rate that has a three handle, in the presence of massive and growing budget deficits and epically easy financial conditions, the idea that inflation would remain robust or even accelerate should not be a surprise to anyone. And that's what this data suggests. It was not me or some outside observer who emphasized the concept of supercore inflation, that is, taking out the transitory stuff and also taking out housing. And by that measure, inflation is running at above a 6% rate, and the three-month rate exceeds the six-month rate, and the six-month rate exceeds the one-year rate. This confirms the idea that the neutral rate is way above the 2.6% level that the Fed has been using as a North Star. In my view, puts back on the table. It is still not what I would expect, but you have to take seriously the possibility that the next rate move will be upwards rather than downwards. And anything could happen. Markets could crash, the indicators could turn down. But on current facts, a rate cut in June, it seems to me, would be a dangerous and egregious error, comparable to the errors the Fed was making in the summer of 2021, when it just didn't get the thread on inflation.
Larry, you mentioned the supercore that, as I recall, Chair Jay Powell, among others, has talked about specifically. It raises the issue of, are there aberrations you see in these data? We hear some people saying, wait a second, this is really housing and auto insurance. There are a couple of outliers and that the rest isn't as troublesome. Is that right?
I don't think so. Look, you can always find particular indicators that are up or down, but when you're making up a story month after month, that's a problem. When commodity prices are spiking and those are being taken as a market indicator of inflation expectations, when breakevens have risen when the political economy of the country is heavily about inflation, trying to dismiss it on an indicator by indicator basis is an odd thing to do. Look, it is a technical subject, the price indices for housing. I don't think there are many Americans who feel like housing is becoming lots more affordable these days. They really don't. And so to argue that somehow housing isn't a source of inflation psychology seems to me to be quite a surprising view to take. Look, why are we thinking about rate cuts when the economy is below what the Fed thinks is the normal unemployment rate, when the economy is growing faster than what the Fed thinks is potential, and when inflation is unambiguously above target and plausibly accelerating? The Fed has once again, in important respects, lost its way over the last 6 or 9 months in the same way, making policy and making forecasts based on hope rather than on a hard-headed look at reality. I think that the Fed did a good job of cleaning up on the errors they had made in 2021. And I think it's reasonable to think that they will pivot off the errors they made last fall that led markets to be ludicrously expecting 6 cuts this year. And I'm hopeful that that will happen. But I think the Fed does need to learn some important lessons from this experience. Let me say one other thing, if I could, David. There's been a lot of talk about 1995 as some kind of useful analogy. I think not. The unemployment rate was 5.6% in 1995. Equity markets, as shown by the fact that they more than doubled subsequently, were not frothy, particularly in 1995. We had just come off a major program of deficit reduction rather than being in a program of unprecedented fiscal expansion. And we had really clear evidence of a kind we don't yet have now of productivity acceleration. And interest rates were higher than they are right now. So the case that somehow this moment looks like 1995 and that's a reason for cutting is something that I find inexplicable. Another thing that it seems to me is problematic is the notions that are increasingly being bruited about that the Fed is going to slow QT. Of course, one of the things that today's movement in interest rates, the interest rates moves that we've seen over the last month mean is that the Fed's efforts to do parity trades in the bond market have proven to be extremely expensive for taxpayers. And the length of time for which the Fed is going to be showing annual losses or on a mark-to-market basis, large balance sheet losses, that looks like it's longer than we thought some months ago. So we need a Fed that stays focused on what is very clearly the focus of the American people, which is price stability. And I'm afraid there are some signs that in the last few months they have lost their focus in favor of more ambitious economic theories about preempting slack that's not happening or some such.
Larry, you're always the first to warn us that things can change. So we can't predict what's going to happen in the fall and into next year. You've said you think it's definitely a mistake for the Fed to cut in June. But given where we are right now, what you know right now, if you had to make a decision, are we going to see any cuts this year? And what is the likelihood of actually an increase?
Just to quibble with what you said, I said on current facts, I see no case for a cut in June, but facts can change. Right. Inflation indicators could come in much lower than most of us are expecting. The economy could turn down. So never make an absolute judgment about policy several months from now, because all kinds of surprises could happen. I think the odds are that the next rate cut will be down rather than up. But I think you have to assign a greater probability to the next rate cut, rate move being up than you did several months ago. I don't know whether it's 15% or it's 25%, but somewhere in that range is what I would say for the next rate cut, rate being up. I still think the odds probably favor another rate cut this year, but not by very much, and not by as much as is priced into the markets, even after the adjustment that we have seen. So reality, markets are adjusting to reality. The Fed is adjusting to reality, but I think the process is slower than would be ideal.
Larry, let me ask what for some of us might be the scary question, which is, does the Fed have the power to get their arms around inflation at this point through monetary policy, or are there other factors that are larger than what they can really affect over the shorter medium term?
I think the Fed has considerable influence over inflation expectations, which are an important determinant of subsequent inflation. I think monetary restraint does influence the economy, which feeds through into the inflation process. But gosh, we ought to be doing everything we can on the supply side. Anytime anybody sees a bottleneck, we ought to be going after it. I am all for effective competition policy that restrains price increases. I think the most important competition policy is maintaining economic openness and allowing competition for U.S. goods from less expensive foreign goods. That's the most important competition policy. That's the most important anti-gouging policy. That's the most important contain excessive profit margins policy. And so I'm sorry to see the extent of bipartisan consensus in favor of policies that are relatively protectionist. Do people really think there is an overwhelming danger that we're going to have excessive production of batteries in the world given climate change? Do people really think there's an overwhelming danger that we're going to have an excessive effort to use solar power? If not, I worry in inflationary times about policymakers decrying the growth of capacity. And there's been a certain amount of that on Secretary Yellen's trip to China and in U.S. rhetoric on a bipartisan basis. So yes, we should compliment the Fed with fiscal policies that are oriented towards restoring credibility, recognizing the defense spending that's going to need to come and allowing for it, and with microeconomic policies that are competition promoting, the most important of which is openness to the global economy with respect to goods, with respect to labor, with respect to the flow of capital.
So, Larry, you mentioned 1995 and productivity. Is there some hope, perhaps, that we could get some relief from inflation because of generative AI? You're on the board of OpenAI. We had Jamie Dimon this week come out with his letter saying it's like a steam engine. You, at one point, I think, said it was like fire. Is there a prospect that we could get some downside risk, as it were, to inflation from generative AI?
I think it's a question about horizons, David. And again, I never make completely confident predictions, because the one thing we know about the economy is that it surprises us. I think that's potentially a very important factor if you look 3 or 4 years out. I would be very surprised if it was an important factor in the next year or two. And I think the fact that OpenAI, or not OpenAI, artificial intelligence is a potential competitor for commentators leads this to kind of have more salience in commentary than it otherwise would. So yes, for the long run, I think this could be a huge event for inflation, a huge event for productivity growth. But I'd be pretty surprised if the effects were really large in the short run.
And I thank you for mentioning commentators and not interviewers in that sentence. I really appreciate that. One last question. It's important to Bloomberg audiences in particular. Financial conditions. You referred to the signaling of cuts last fall. Financial conditions have been sort of off to the races here. To what extent do you think financial conditions played a significant role in these numbers we got today?
Well, I think there's no question that the $12 trillion of wealth that have been created have contributed to greater spending, which has contributed to inflationary pressure. I think the availability of credit has had similar kinds of effects. So I think it's hard to quantify precisely, but I think there's no question that financial conditions have had a role. But look, David, sometimes the indicators or different indicators are pointing in different directions. This time, activity is super fast. Unemployment is very low. Fiscal is highly expansionary. Financial conditions are very loose. And on the ground, inflation measures are above target and possibly accelerating. What is the theory of a rate cut into configuration right now? I don't think there is one. And I think that the Fed has a communication challenge in keeping it on the table, because again, anything can happen. It can be financial accidents. There can be sudden changes towards reduced employment. There can be global developments. So never rule anything out. But I think there is a communication challenge around the fact that in the mainstream scenario, we do not need rate cuts right now.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.